I think we'll get started. We'll call the Business, Industry, and Jobs Committee March 3rd, 2008 meeting to order. I think we're short of a quorum at this time, but we do have eight bills, so we've got to get moving. And so the first bill we'll hear this afternoon will be Senator Sharon's bill, Senate File 3140, as it pertains to boiler operations licensing. And welcome to the committee, Senator, and you may proceed.
Thank you, Chair Metzen. I'd like to begin by offering an amendment to the bill that will place the bill in the form in which it is intended by the author. It would be... Thank you. 40A1 amendment.
To Senator... What do we need? 2, 4, 5, 6. Okay, maybe before we recognize Senator Scheid's motion that you want her to make for you or somebody to make for you, maybe can you tell us what the amendment does?
Well, this is an amendment that adds a language to the bill that allows for 16-year-olds, if they have a license. Perhaps I'll turn this over to someone who can really articulate it very well, if you would not
mind. Sure, that's fine. Just identify yourself and talk to us at this time just about the amendment.
My name is Joel Amato, and I'm Chief Boiler Inspector for the state. This bill would allow 16-year-olds to operate historical boilers. And the purpose of this bill is to get a younger crowd into operating the historical boilers or the hobby or steam engines. It also increases the number of operating hours or experience required before a individual may obtain a license from 25 hours to 50 hours.
Okay. All right. Now we're going to – any questions on the amendment? Okay, why don't – let's quickly go through the bill, and we'll move the amendment as soon as we have nine people. Senator Scoy.
Mr. Chair, and they're adding the condition that there's at least 50 hours of operating experience and 16 hours. What's currently is the – is there any hours criteria currently that you're overriding here?
Sir.
Mr. Chairman, the current number of hours required to test for a historical boiler license is 25. They're increasing it to 50, or the request is to increase it to a total of 50 hours of operating experience, but allow up to 16 of those to be actual attendance at a school for that type of operation of those boilers.
Okay, I think we understand the amendment. Now on the bill. Give it some explanation of the bill. What else is in the bill?
So on the main bill itself?
That's correct.
Thank you, Chair. I would just like you to know as I introduce this bill that my involvement in the bill started in Mankato, and I really want to tell you this because it's about an employee of the state of Minnesota who, as a result of the work that she did, began to pick up a trend, a problem that was existing in the industry around boiler operators. Her job, and her name is Sandra Rademacher, and I want to acknowledge her, was to help industry in order to be successful and to find employees to meet industry needs. And she began to see a pattern of problems in the area of boiler operators, and as a result of that, pulled together a summit of people, stakeholders in boiler operators, in the state of Minnesota, the industry, labor, all together in a meeting. And out of that meeting, a committee was formed that worked over the entire summer in order to make these proposals that are here in front of you today. And I just want to... You know, so many times people talk about state employees and have comments about their their ability to take initiative and to solve problems. And I can tell you we have an absolutely phenomenal employee whose work, and as a result of that initiative, was able to put this together. So with that, I'm going to also ask Joel, who has been working all summer with a team of people, of stakeholders, and who has mediated all of the interests of these stakeholders and formulated this proposal that's in front of you today, to go through the essential changes that are occurring and what goals that they'll achieve. Thank you.
Seems like you've put a lot of work into this legislation.
I think that we'll go through the bill.
Okay, fine. Just proceed.
Yeah, here's a summary of everything that's in the bill.
Okay.
I'll do that if you want me to.
Mr. Chairman, Senators, I'm going to just do a brief overview of what the bill contains. And if you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer them. The reason for this was the shortage of the engineers, and what we've done is we're trying to create a provisional license that would allow second-class engineers to operate as first-class engineers in a limited facility or at one facility only. And by doing this, by having an internal training program at the facility that would train these engineers to operate on their facility only, we believe that they would be trained to operate those specific boilers, which would then further retain those engineers at that facility and allow them to work their way up to the first-class engineer. As you can see, there are several requirements in the bill for people that would like to be provisionally licensed or for plants that would like to utilize the provisional license. The other thing I wanted to clarify on this bill is one out of 18351, which talks about the commissioner, and if the commissioner approves an application for a license, that allows that applicant to test at least once or only once during a one-year time period. The other thing that we would like to add to this bill is that the commissioner may require continuing education prior to the renewal of any license. And the reason we are adding this is because the committee has not decided as to the number of hours required for each individual license yet. I need to go through all of these little exemptions.
Do you want us to go through each of the changes in the bill?
It just summary? The changes are the
horsepower.
The horsepower on a lot of them. I don't personally care to hear about. Let me make a general statement that I applaud the author for all the hard work you've done on this, and you pulled in all the. I think you pulled in all the players. Is that correct?
That's correct.
And I think you're hopefully. Is there anybody opposed to what we're trying to do here in this boiler language? And we do have a quorum. But I don't know, unless the committee members want to hear more, but it sounds like this is a style that Senator Scheid and I and the late Senator Solon and some others have tried to do for 20 years around here, is to get people working together and do your work outside of this room, usually, see? And I believe that this is an example of something getting ironed out, worked out ahead of time. So with that, Senator Scheid renews her motion on the amendment that we've discussed, I believe, thoroughly. We do have a quorum. All those in favor of the amendment, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, motion prevails. Any further discussion by any of the committee members or the audience for or against this legislation? Senator Sharon, I see something in here that deals with the rulemaking, and I believe it'll have to go to state and local because of, there's a GovOp or what? State and Local Government Ops Committee. But I think it's a minor thing. It seems to be. Get your hearing, and it should be a couple of minutes, I hope. But so that'll be the motion that Senator Scheid makes, that be recommended to pass as amended and forwarded on to the local and governmental operations committee. Further discussion? See, not all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, motion prevails. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Senator Scheid and Senator Kubley, you two have also been working on some plumbers' issues. And would you both like to come up to together, and how are we going to do this? We're going to end up with one bill, or? Well, we'll figure it out. We have Senate File 2786, Senator Scheid, and Senate File 2663, Senator Coobley, and you may proceed as you so wish.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I'll explain kind of what got us here. Okay. Members might remember that over the last couple of years we had, first of all, we started with the governor's reorganization of a number of the trades, Board of Electricity, Plumbing, all of those boards that have to do with construction and the governance and the regulation of those professions brought together into the Labor and Industry Department. And we did that, I think, 2 years ago. Last year we had a major bill that described requirements for licensure and who could do what. It was quite a lengthy process of people working it out, labor and management, the administration, everybody trying to, I think, and everybody did have input into that, and we knew that we would probably have issues that would arise out of that, some things that hadn't been considered. One of those things that happened was that while we allowed certain people to get what's called a restricted master plumber license or a restricted journeyman plumber license, and so that they could keep on doing their plumbing work that they'd been doing around the state, except they wouldn't be able to do that in cities and towns with a population of over 5,000. So this was in small, greater Minnesota areas. And what happened was, now they had to, the law said that all applications had to be submitted by January 1 of this year, of 2008. And some of us learned that this deadline didn't give everyone an opportunity to apply. So we, Representative Mahoney and I encouraged the commissioner to
kind of, the waivers?
Well, I'm not sure that the department did exactly that, but they just to work with this issue because we wanted to give people, we didn't want to put people out of business. Yeah. We wanted people to have time. So that's where our bills come in. And my, the legislation I'm promoting here, Senate File 2786, talks about October 1 as opposed to January 1 of this year, which has obviously gone by. And we show that it seems to me we've reduced the, they have to show just 2 years of experience rather than four. Rodney Ellingbo is here. Do you want to comment on this at all?
Sure.
State your name
from
for the record.
Department.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Randy Ellingbo, and I am the manager of the Plumbing Plan Review and Inspection Unit at the Department of Labor and Industry, and we administer the plumbing code and work with licensed plumbers across the state. And very briefly, in relation to the language in Senate File 2786, it as Senator Scheid mentioned, extends the deadline to apply for a restricted master or restricted journeyman plumber's license to October 1st, 2008. And it also, there's just a slight rephrasing of the language on restricted journeyman plumber and who may apply for that license. There is a slight addition, as Senator Scheid mentioned, in terms of eligibility on the restricted master plumber license. The original legislation required 4 years of experience in practical plumbing to obtain a restricted master plumber license. This language also allows someone who can show 2 years of experience as a plumbing contractor to purchase the restricted master license. And the idea behind that is that it was to allow those people who have been in the business of plumbing for two or more years to apply for the restricted master license, which is what's required to be in charge of work for a plumbing shop. And That's the basic gist of the language. It is intended that this would become effective immediately in following or following enactment to allow us the maximum amount of time to have people apply for the license. So.
It seems to me a lot of the problems were with the notifications and things. Is that correct? And the confusion out there, and we're giving these people a second chance or something? I don't think we're – because it was kind of our fault, too, wasn't it, the states? And we don't have to get in a long debate about that, but it seems to me that this is the right thing to do because wasn't all those people's their own fault that it didn't get done, right? Or am I missing part of it?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the folks who received, we notified as many people as we could think of last year in terms of obtaining the license. The requirement for the original legislation had a requirement that the people who obtained the license had to be in compliance with the bond requirements. There's a $25,000 plumbing code compliance bond requirement in statute, and all of the people who were in compliance with that bond requirement, as well as all of the registered apprentices in the state's registry, received the information. Those were the people who were eligible to obtain the license under the legislation passed last year. This legislation opens it up to the people who were not in compliance with the bond.
Right. It seems to me your statement a couple of minutes ago, you'd notified as many people as possible, means to me that not everybody got notified, of course. So we're trying to fix that up. And I see Senator Kubley has the same. He's got the dates on his, too. I think you got a couple more.
Mr. Chair.
I appreciate Senator Kubley bringing Senator Scheid this to our attention. I've heard about this problem, but yeah. Senator Kubley.
Well, yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I think the only difference between Senator Scheid's bill and mine, or you know, at least the one that stands out, is the effective date. And I don't want to get into any kind of a fight over the date. I guess you know I've only done two other licensing bills, and I had to do them over because the window wasn't long enough to accommodate everybody. And so, you know, I was trying to avoid that by making the window a little bit longer. But I brought with me today Mr. Mike Fisher, who lives out in Big Stone County. He certainly doesn't have a problem with, you know, complying with this. I think he is one of the people who fell through the cracks. And, you know, certainly living in a town of less than 5,000 people isn't a problem for Mr. Fisher. By the next census, he may live in a county of less than 5,000 people. But anyway, I'd like to, you know, give Mr. Fisher an opportunity to share his story with the committee, Mr. Chair.
Sure. Welcome to the Capitol, Mr. Fisher, and you may proceed.
Well, I'm Mike Fisher from Graceville, Minnesota, and I've been doing plumbing for about 30 years. I'm a full-time employee at a school district, and I'm getting ready to retire. I wasn't notified that I had to have a license, and I found out about 2 weeks too short because I applied, and it was after the date. And I've been serving these people for 30 years, and I got a lot of customers that I'd like to continue servicing for myself and for them, and I'd like the window to be changed so I can get the license and do
this,
what I have
Mr.
to do.
Fisher will give you the window that you need to get back in, and that's what we're here for, to try to correct the situation. And
yeah, that'd be fine.
Yeah, that's what I. Yeah, there's a little.
Mr. Fisher is bonded, Mr. Chair, so he has he's complied with that portion of the requirement, so he does carry a bond.
It's just not registered with the state.
No.
Yeah, it just seems to me we've got to correct this thing and get her on the right track. And I don't know if there's any questions from the panel or the senators. Senator, are you going to? Is it going to be Senator Kubley's bill or Senator Scheid's? Or
Mr. Chair,
to get it passed. I'm sure.
I think moving with Senator Scheid's bill, hers is identical to the one that is in the House, and so you know, I think even though I do have one in the House, I think we could move ahead with that bill and be comfortable that the people that need the opportunity for an extension are covered.
Okay, that's.
Mr.
Yeah, Senator Scheid.
Mr. Chairman, 2786, the bill that I have, has the additional language that's changing from 4 years to 2 years for those restricted licenses. I don't think Senator Kubles has that language, but the his bill does deal with the the date issue, and I think
you go
say that October 1st this year is fine.
Yeah, I think
a little further on the waivers too. I think where yours gives a
Senator Scheid's bill is has those issues. I think that's just fine. It just wouldn't affect my constituent there, Mr. Chair.
Senator, any further questions? Anybody in the audience wish to be heard for or against this legislation? Senator Scheid, did you wish to move that?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd move that Senate File 2786 be recommended to pass.
Further discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, motion prevails. Senator Scheid, thanks for coming down, Mr. Fisher, and welcome.
Yeah.
We'll talk about Senate File 2926, Senator Scheid.
Comes my partner, Mr. Joe Akam, to help me through this. This has to do with the same legislation we were just talking about, the major recodification, but also new language that affected the different trades that we passed last year. And I think we're kind of thinking of this as kind of a cleanup bill. It's something that we needed to use some clarifying language. Don't know how much. I guess I would like to move an author's amendment, if I might, the A1. And that would put it in the shape in which I'd like.
Okay, is it purely technical, or is there something we should know about the amendment, Mr. Joe Akam?
Mr. Chair, committee members, this amendment puts the language for the in part of the bill for the contractor licensing, there was two bills that passed last year with different language. The language that was signed last was the one that was officially noticed. This puts – we met with all the parties involved and came up with this language that everybody agreed to so we could amend our bill – amend actually the two bills that passed last year and put this correct language in Subdivision 2 for insurance criteria.
And then, Mr. Chairman, there's just some language.
Okay, has this been anybody opposed to this? I can't figure it out that fast, but if everybody agrees, any objection? All right. Senator.
I move the A1 amendment, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Scheid moves the A1 amendment. Discussion. All those in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed. Motion prevails. Amendment is adopted. I proceed with the bill.
Okay. Do you want to talk about
Mr. Chairman?
We don't need every section, I think.
Committee members, this cleanup bill, last year we had a 200-page code consolidation bill following the governor's consolidation effort. There was a number of pieces of the bill that were heard in various committees, and at the end there's a number of things that were totaled in the bill. And there was some grammatical changes and technical wording changes that need to be corrected. I'm going to walk you through just some of the highlights of the bill. I won't get into some of the grammatical or clarifying changes. But, for example, in Section 1, we're just trying to clarify. There was a section added 2 or 3 years ago that required our agency to have a minimum of 180 days after we put rules through the process before they go into effect. Well, the way it was language read, we could not adopt after 180 days. We had to adopt at 180 days. And then we wanted an exception that if we give proper notice that if all industries agree that we wanted to do something in a shorter time period, that we had an option to do that. So give us some flexibility with the rule adoption. Section 8 is just a clarification. We passed three boards, authoritative boards, last session, and it's a clarification that the Board of Electricity, and it's not the commissioner that has the responsibility for adoption of the rule. Some of these changes just didn't get caught in the process. just going to go through the. There's a couple more on section 14 and 15. It gets into the correct terminology for technology circuits.
Mr. Joachim.
Oh, excuse me.
You see consistency, terminology, cross-reference, grammatical errors, unnecessary words, corrects the cross-reference. We don't care about hearing about those, okay?
Okay.
If there are any, because, just loaded with those kinds of. So tell us what's important in here. I'm sure it's all important, but what's changed that we should hear about?
Mr. Chair, committee members, the section 19 and 20 and 21 talk about the plumbing issues, and we already addressed those in an earlier bill, so I don't need to talk about those. There, in both of the two boards that we adopted last year, high-pressure piping and plumbing, we inserted the public member as part of the board. We did not address that the public member did not have to be licensed, so we had to clarify, and if you're a public member, you have to be a public member, not associated with any license of the board, and the board language said everybody had to be licensed and didn't exempt out the public member, so we needed to do that. Section 36 is the clarification that we just amended onto the bill here. Probably one of the biggest issues, I think, is Section 49, is there was a repealer last year that repealed advisory councils, and we had reinstated the Construction Codes Advisory Council in our code bill last year, and the repealer repealed it out. So we're putting it back in place again. So an industry wanted a Construction Codes Advisory Council that is the umbrella to give information back to the commissioner on code adoption and advice to the commissioner on any licensing or enforcement criteria.
Okay. So,
and those are the major issues in this. It's a 40-page cleanup bill.
I hate those. Discussion by the members. Anybody in the audience objecting to what this bill does?
Mr. Chairman.
It looks like it mostly.
Yeah, the department did work with industry to come to these resolutions.
Oh, that's usually how you do it, Senator Scheid. Appreciate that. You want to move your own bill here then? Any questions from the Senator Scheid?
Mr. Chairman, I do. I know that there were some folks who are interested in manufactured home installing or installers, and they have asked for some language, but I'm not confident in that we will do what it is they want to do or that we should do it. I'd like to continue to work on that, and I think that they could maybe work on that in the other body, but I wanted to tell you that there may be something. I don't know if Mr. Joachim wants to comment on that. There was an issue about people who are manufactured home installers and plumbing, in doing plumbing work, did they need to also be licensed plumbers? And I think the department agrees, they don't need to be that, but they don't need to be licensed plumbers. They can be licensed manufactured home installers, and then they can hook up the sewer and the water lines. And they're able to do that, and we want to make sure that they're able to continue to do that work. I just don't know that I was consulting with Mr. Fuller, and he was able to put some of their request into an amendment, but it was difficult to do all of it in the short time frame that we had. So
I want
to tell those people, and they may want to speak, but I want them to keep working on that. And
if they want to be heard, I asked a couple times if anybody in the audience wanted to be heard, and nobody stepped forward. But why don't we – I think we can move it out of here, but I'd like to see you, Senator Scheid, work on that provision that might work and not let it up to the other body. So they can do it too, but you work with our council and manufactured home people and bring your amendment to the Senate floor.
Mr. Chairman, absolutely.
Don't you give up, because we don't want to – we can't have that other body kind of fixing up our stuff.
And So did we do this today?
Right.
We did the A1 amendment, I'm correct.
Yeah.
So, Mr. Chairman, then I would move that Senate file 2926 as amended be recommended to pass.
Any further discussion on the bill as amended? Seeing none, all those in favor of the Scheid motion. Is there some rulemaking stuff in here or something we have to go somewhere else? Oh, did they request this one? I guess you might have another stop.
Okay,
I'm told I'd send it a rest to, apparently he's asked for it. So that'll be incorporated into your, I don't see anything in here why, but usually we accommodate our colleagues if they ask for a bill. So that's the new motion by Senator Scheid. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you.
Chairman, thank you.
Thank you.
Senator Tomasoni, are you ready with the technology? Well, you've got two here, whichever one you'd like to, technology. We'll go with the Senate File 2468, Senator Tomasoni.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and committee members. Senate File 2468 is called the renaming of Minnesota Technology, Inc. to Enterprise Minnesota, Inc. It's been about 17 years, Mr. Chairman and committee members, since there's been any language updates to the Minnesota Technology statute. And since the organization has evolved from receiving state appropriations for its operations and has moved to a fee-based sales structure, it's time to update the statutes to reflect the organization in 2008 and going forward from here. The bill essentially removes outdated functions and makes technical changes. Additionally, the bill changes the name of the organization to Enterprise Minnesota, Inc., and that essentially removes a lot of confusion from something called the Minnesota High Tech Association. And lastly, what it does is it removes a salary cap from the president of the organization. And I think we can move to Mr. Carnival here to explain the bill itself.
Mr. Carnival.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. I think Mr. Chair, I think there's an amendment in your packet, the A2 amendment, but if not, we'll take care of that another time.
It's a technical change to a technical
exactly.
The A2 amendment? What are we doing here?
Mr. Chair, let me explain the amendment. As Senator Tomasoni mentioned, we're making some technical changes to try and update the statutes for Minnesota Technology and along with changing its name. This simply preserves the Agricultural Utilization Research Institute so as not to go away and disappear through the technical changes and repealers that we have in this bill. It moves it to a different section of statute, and the revisor's office indicated that this is necessary so as not to make it disappear through the action in this bill. So it technically moves it to a different section of statute.
Okay, this is a form you want it.
This is a form I'd like to put the bill in, Mr. Chairman.
I will do that. Now, Senator Bach.
Mr. Chairman, does counsel agree that's what the amendment does?
Hmm. Well, we're not worried about him today. We're just going to take care of matters in our own hands here.
I mean, I like Mr. Carnival, but I'd like to know if counsel agrees with it.
Trust but verify, right?
Do you want to weigh in on this? I think you're being asked to. By Senator Bach, a question. Did you hear it?
I had looked at this amendment, but I hadn't studied it closely. The language is slightly different than the original law, but I think it's the same. The question that I had brought forward is whether or not we should make sure that we're continuing Minnesota or ARI because we repeal it and we reenact it. And oftentimes, and I don't think this is crucial at this juncture, but to make sure that what we have is a seamless continuation of this entity, ORI, there might be some discussions about whether or not we should do the amendment to the current law and just have a revisor's instruction. Because this gives the appearance that it's been eliminated and then started up again. And I don't think that's the intent. I think the intent is that whoever the employees are, whatever their financing is the same. So that's the only concern I notice with respect to it.
Thank you. Chairman, my old friend, former Senator Dallas Sams, would not want this committee to do anything to get rid of ORI.
Mr. Chair.
Very good. Thank you.
We have no intention whatsoever. That, matter of fact, this language is to make sure that that does not happen.
Mr. Carnival, I see on the Section 6, Subdivision 1, where you're the 95% governor's salary thing is, first of all, I think that stuff shouldn't be around anyway, because you got to pay. We're losing city managers. We're losing a lot of people. But quite frankly, I'm going to do this for our zoo director, but the funds, the additional funds, are not state funds.
Correct.
I want to know if that's, you're doing that here, that it will not be state funds to augment that boost in salary. Can you assure me of that?
Mr. Chair, absolutely. This organization, historically, as you recall, started out as the Greater Minnesota Corporation in the 70s, evolved into Minnesota Technology, and during that time it received a substantial amount of its funding from state funds.
Right, yeah.
However, in the last 3 years, the legislature has, during budget cuts, eliminated any appropriations for the organization for operations. So there is no state appropriation.
Oh.
No state appropriation, so the reason to eliminate this is so on the open market they can find people who are competent and capable to operate the organization in the way that needs to be done in the marketplace.
But I had to be educated just a little bit here. Okay, that makes it easier, obviously, but because we don't want to deviate that cap too often. But Senator Tomasoni, did you have any more to add?
No, but I just want to make sure, Mr. Chairman, that the point that Mr. Fuller brought up here, that we follow through with it, and that we don't eliminate an agency and then bring it back and then kinds of problems in the interim of trying to figure out what we just did. So I understand that the intent of my amendment is to do just that, but I just want to make sure that before we pass it, that ends up happening.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, on that point, should there be any need for any additional information that Council believes necessary to make sure AURI continues and does not injure its situation, we're perfectly happy to add that at any point along the way, sir.
Senator Scoy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Senator Tomasoni. I talked to the folks up at AURI about the bill. They did not mention this A2 amendment in our discussions that we had with them. Have they seen this amendment that you know?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Scoy, I think the amendment is a result of them not having seen the bill. But anyway, go ahead, Mr.
Chair.
Senator.
Senator Scoy.
Scoy.
Yes, as a matter of fact, when the bill was introduced and the language eliminated AORI, Council in the House, the other body, suggested that we needed to take care of this amendment, and Representative Mahoney and his staff, who are the authors in the House, he discussed this with the staff at AORI, and they're very comfortable with the language that's in Amendment Number to A2.
Thank you.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman, if there's...
Mr. Killer, is there any need for any further discussion on this this bill?
Mr. Chair, Mr. Kill will be here if you have any questions.
Okay. Any further discussion? Anybody in the audience wish to speak for or against this Senate File 2468? Do we have the amendment? Has it been adopted yet?
No.
Senator Scoy, I'll move the amendment. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, motion prevails on the bill as amended. Senator Tommy, further discussion? Senator Tomasoni.
Mr. Chairman, I think this has to go to finance.
Yeah, they've asked for it. So that'll be Senator Tomasoni's motion that the bill as amended be recommended to pass and forwarded to the finance committee. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, motion prevails. Are you ready, Senator Tomasoni, for the trucking?
Thank you, sir. I believe so.
Let's excuse me, ask Ryan. Ryan? Senator Michelle?
This is a workers' that's a good idea.
Senator Tomasoni.
Mr. Chairman, did you give him instructions to not adjourn the committee?
Getting kind of hungry?
Come and get me. I'll be down.
Mr. Chairman and committee members, Senate File 2688 is a bill relating to unemployment compensation and eliminating an exception to a general rule for determining independent contractor status. You know, we all listened to the Office of the Legislative Auditor's report on independent contractors and how one out of seven were misclassified, and the, one of the results of it is employees not getting some of the benefits that they normally would be getting, and also as a result of it that tax collections are less than what they would be as a result of it. What this does is, because it appears to be that there's might be a problem in the trucking industry, that it, this particular bill allows the Department of Economic Development to conduct sufficient audits on the trucking industry to determine if there's a pattern of improper classification, and it also makes the independent contractor law uniform for everybody, and does not have any kind of exceptions for anybody. So we have a set of five essential factors that must be considered when determining worker status. And I think you have the little thing in your packet, and you also have the report from the Office of the Legislative Auditor. And I'll let Mr. Gertesmeyer elaborate on this a little bit further.
Mr. Gertesmeyer, welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Don Gertesmeyer, and I'm political director for Teamsters Joint Council 32. The only official voice for all 56,000 active and retired members in the state of Minnesota. I'm here today to testify in support of Senate File 2688. And as Senator Tomasoni just said, I think each of you have a copy of the legislative auditor's report, a seven-page rulemaking decision that the state uses as far as deciding independent contractor status and the exception for the trucking industry. And as you are aware, the legislative audit report was released last year and had many recommendations. The audit report specifically recommended, and I quote, the legislature should work to standardize the criteria in the state law and rule to determine worker status. We believe the legislation would, in fact, move in the direction to standardize worker status by ensuring that the Department of Employment and Economic Development audits suspected employers in the trucking industry that have been found guilty in other states and jurisdictions of misclassifying workers. To eliminate the statute regarding the truck industry that provides a loophole for employers that would give them the ability to exploit Minnesota workers, specifically Minnesota Statute 2007 Supplement, Section 2268.035, Subdivision 25B, which you have a copy of. Audits in California, and there was an audit done on a trucking company that subsequently found them guilty of misclassifying their workers. In the case, the employer was ordered to pay in excess of $5.3 million to its workers and the state in unpaid taxes and benefits. In another recent audit and ruling in Massachusetts, they again found the same company in violation of state law and were ultimately fined $190,000 in order to fix the employment status and pay 13 drivers restitution. I would also like to give you a few examples of how misclassification of employers hurts our state, our workers, and honest employers in our state. First is burden in taxes. The shifting of burden to paying taxes, workers' compensation, and unemployment taxes onto individual employees result in many workers intentionally or unintentionally not making full payments. The companies continue to avoid payments that rightfully are their responsibility as an employer, while the state funds may be shortchanged through noncompliance. Also, in many cases, workers that are considered independent contractors that are hurt on the job receive medical treatment but lack medical insurance coverage, thus again shifting the burden back to us, the rest of society. Second, employers who knowingly misuse independent contractor status can gain a cost advantage versus competitors that adhere to state laws. For example, according to testimony by the Legislative Auditor's Office before the Senate Tax Committee on February 19th, An employer that classifies their employee as an independent contractor saves about $7.82 an hour on a $30 rate in unpaid unemployment, workman's comp, and taxes. It would amount to about $16,000 a year. Employers' savings to an employee that misclassifies their employees. By these numbers, as you can see, why most testimony by the Legislative Auditor's Office that many times classification is not done accidentally. Misclassification of employees is a serious issue being addressed in many states during their legislative session. It is our understanding that at least 10 states are currently taking action along the issue of misclassification of workers. Pennsylvania and New Jersey will be added to that list. New York, Michigan, and the governors have under executive order a misclassification task force. I've got numbers from the state of New York if you'd be interested, but we're giving you way more stuff. And I do have copies of my testimony today if you'd like. It makes good, sound policy that Minnesota protect its workers and the trucking industry by classifying them correctly, protects the integrity of our tax base, and honest business owners that pay their fair share. Mr. Chairman and committee members, understanding the budget deficit that we're informed of last week, it would be judicious to look into the possibilities of ensuring that employers are not circumventing their responsibilities to our state and their workers. The legislation would work into that direction. We appreciate the opportunity to address you on this issue and ask that you support Senate File 2688.
Thank you, Mr. Gerstmeyer. Senator Tomasoni, do you have anyone else that you'd like to have as witnesses?
No, I don't.
Okay.
I don't know. Questions? If Senator Scoy. Anybody else that would like to testify.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And maybe before the witness leaves, because I see the trucking industry is going to come up and probably oppose this. But I'm reading the what you're repealing on the back. And
yes.
You know, I agree with everything that you said about you don't want people misclassifying their employees as independent contractors. It's just not something that the state should be at all supportive of. But why are you repealing this definition for the trucking industry independent contractors? It appears pretty tight, pretty accurate, and seems reasonable to me that we would leave these definitions in place and then just make sure that they're complying with them.
Mr. Chair, Senator Scoy.
Mr. Gerstmeyer.
The reason that the advice we were given is, and the complaint generally, as we looked at this for since last year, is that the three departments, revenue, labor and industry, and employment economic development, all use slightly different criteria for identifying independent contractors. It would seem to us to get to one definition. And the state has a seven-page definition, which I think you were given, as to determining worker status. And then at some point in time, there was an exception put in for the trucking industry, and then that was amended last year. And I'm not sure where it came from or how it got there, but I know that the one complaint generally across the commissioners and enforcement agencies is that things aren't the same in all three departments. So that's what we're striving to do, is get to one definition.
Senator Scoy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, yes, I would certainly agree that all three agencies should be using the same definition. But if there's a reason that the trucking industry has a little different definition, they should just be using that equally across all three agencies. And you know, Senator Tomasoni, I mean, I support Section 1, but I'm not going to be supportive of Section 2, and at some point I'm going to move to remove that.
And Senator Scoy, maybe perhaps it's time to bring up the spokesman for the Trucking Association. Senator Thompson, anything else you want to add at this point?
Well, I think the reason for removing it, Senator Scoy, is because of the fact that this is an exception to the way of classifying independent contractors, and it related specifically to the trucking industry. And one of the recommendations of the legislative auditor was to standardize the criteria in state law that you use for determining. And this is definitely targeted to one individual industry and has its own set of rules, whereas everybody else is had worked under something else. And I think the idea here is to make sure that everybody is is having the independent contract law applied to them equally and not have exceptions in the law.
Well, Senator Skoy.
Well, Mr. Chair and Senator Tomasoni, perhaps there was a real good reason that this was put into place to begin with, and I'll be interested to hear from the trucking industry as to what that reason was.
And we can hear from the, and we can also hear from the department too, and from the trucking industry. So.
Mr. Hausladen, do you want to go first,
no, Senator? Just Bonoff? A question. Go ahead.
Okay. No, Senator Bonoff. Let's
thank
let's
you,
take
Mr.
care
Chair.
Of the committee questions.
Mr. Gertesmeyer, if the repealer was taken out, as Senator Skoy mentioned, would you think that that makes this not as effective? Is that important to you,
Mr. Chairman, Senator Bonoff? Yes, I believe it is. One of the things that are lacking in the present 268.035 is control. Who controls the employee? And that's a big determining factor in an independent contractor status. So I think maybe that's where our disagreement is over that piece. We believe that it needs to come out of there. If we're going to follow the legislative auditor's recommendations and try and get to a uniform definition of ICs, it seems that has to happen.
Mr. Hausladen, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members of the committee, my name is John Hausladen. I'm president of the Minnesota Trucking Association, and I am here today to testify in opposition to Senate File 2688. I think Senator Skoy had it right on the nose in that this is really not an issue in the trucking industry today, largely because the definition we have is very good. Minnesota has a rich tradition of being progressive and setting the pace for the nation in a variety of areas. And in fact, in the 1980s, Minnesota was one of the first states that took an administrative rule, crafted it with great certainty, and then later on brought it into the statute. And I think the changes referenced last year were maybe some recodification because the law has been in place for a number of years now. And I think when you think about trucking, what you have to understand is trucking is not monolithic. Trucking operations today are very dynamic and diverse. One day you might be hauling truckload. Tomorrow you might be hauling less than a truckload. Today you might be operating under your own authority. Tomorrow you might be leasing under a different authority. So there are a lot of things about independent contractor definitions that need precision to them. And in the legislative auditor's report, when they cite the numbers of 1 out of 7 not being accurately applied, I'm not sure there are any cases of trucking companies in there, and that is because the definition does work well. I think another thing we must think about is that trucking jobs, if you're an independent contractor, is really a small business on wheels. What you've done is you've made an investment to have this business, take on the debt, make the payments, pay the insurance, and you have the privilege then of running that business wherever you want. So whether you're in the iron range or the timber forest or the agriculture sectors of the state, you can work that job and, frankly, make a very good living. And so we think that the definition has served quite well. As I mentioned, we identified it in the 80s. It's worked well. And, frankly, if you take a look at the department, and you can ask the staff who are here how many complaints they are receiving on this issue, you'll find very small. I do not know exact number, but I can cite one company that has 2,700 owner-operators based in Eagan, Minnesota, and they said if they have over one unemployment compensation claim in a year, that would be a shock to them. That's how well the system works. We think that clarity leads to good application. Frankly, the agency has the authority to do the audits already. We don't see a need for an expanded authority for that. And frankly, we also want to make sure that we are not being unduly targeted as an industry. We think it is a rather large precedent to target one industry for specific audit action, particularly when it doesn't have any record of there being problems. And again, it would be curious to ask the agency if there's been such targeting before. When you compare to other states, again, the statute tries to identify what's happened in other states, and we have to understand that state by state, there are very great differences in the agencies, the laws, their interpretations. And what happens in one state and jurisdiction does not necessarily imply fraud anywhere else. The trucking industry absolutely opposes fraud. It is to our best interest to have people properly classified. And so we think leaving the law as is a good tool. I won't go into the classification. It's not in the bill you see, But if you had it here, you would see the six-point test. And frankly, we think it works well. So having said all that, we do oppose the bill. We think the system is working. I'd be happy to stand for any questions.
Senator Koch.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And actually, my question is for Senator Tomasoni, but along the lines of what Mr. Houseladen was talking about. Leaving aside the repealer, and I share some of Senator Skoy's concerns, what was the impetus or what was the thought process behind targeting the trucking industry? I read the legislative auditor's report as well. I have concerns about the misclassification, but as I recall, I think we started this, or this was kind of the idea that we were going to have the most trouble in the construction area, and it turned out it was real estate or something was at the top of the list for the industry with the most misclassifications. And I'm just wondering what prompted auditing specifically this the trucking industry.
My understanding that there are problems in the trucking industry and that there are misclassifications. And I guess Keith should speak to that more succinctly. The information I have is way different than what the trucking industry just testified. So I'll give Mr. Gerdesmeyer.
Mr.
Chair, Senator.
I'll enlighten you more on that.
In my testimony, I talked there's about 10 states that are currently involved in investigating independent contractor status in the trucking industry. Some of those companies operate in this state. We have many good our union trucking companies that some of this is unfair competition. And Mr. Auschlaven talked about legitimate independent contractors. Nobody wants to harm them. If, in fact, under the law, they're legitimate independent contractors, that's not our goal, is to harm them. But what we are trying to do is to keep people that are competing with our employers on an even scale. And when the auditor himself says it's $7.80 just in benefits advantage, that's a huge difference. And if they're not paying those taxes to the state when we have a $935 million deficit, then I think it prevails on all of us.
Senator Koch.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Gersmeyer, I agree with you, but I'm wondering about your numbers then. Are you finding, I guess, Senator Tomasoni, you alluded to that you've seen different numbers. What are those numbers? Or maybe somebody from the department could come to us and talk to us about the numbers that they're seeing. I'm just wondering why I think it is a problem. I'm just wondering why specifically we're focusing on trucking in this bill. And
Mr. Gardersmeyer.
Mr. Chair, Senator, because that's our field. And secondly, the auditor said 1 in 7, 14%, conservatively 1 in 7. So over 14% of independent contractor status are incorrect. So that's why, you know, these are the people we represent. That's why we're here with this.
Okay. Senator Skoy.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. And just to the members, I guess, more than anything, the 1 in 7 is the correct statistics from what the legislative auditor said, but that doesn't mean you can translate that to the trucking industry. But I'd just like you to take this sheet here that's 3315 and read through that, and now you're a business that are going to make a decision about what status your trucker that you're hiring is. You're a farmer that's got product going to market, and you read this, and can you determine whether that individual is going to be an independent contractor, or read what's on the back of the bill that's going to be repealed. This is so clear and clean and very, very good. I mean, they own their equipment. They're responsible for maintenance, bears the principal burden of operating costs, supplies the personnel to operate. The compensation is based on factors related to work, not hours, and they have a written contract. I mean, it seems like if we repeal that and move to this, it's going to make matters worse.
Mr. Houseladen.
Yes, Mr. Chair, just a couple other quick points. Frankly, Minnesota, again, as I said, has led the way in how they crafted this definition. There are currently 26 other states in the country that have similar exemptions for trucking, and they look to Minnesota's language as a beacon to know how to draft that, and we take pride in that. And I think on a national level, as they look at definitions, they continue to look back at that. I think another thing that is important is that if you were to repeal this language, go to the language that Senator Skoy was citing, the kind of audit mess and uncertainty you would create would wreak havoc. And again, as Mr. Gutesmeyer mentioned, we have a state budget deficit. We need to have businesses stay in Minnesota. We need to have businesses locate in Minnesota. People locate here because there is certainty with this independent contractor definition. If you are to repeal it, now you're going to make Minnesota less positive place for people to expand their trucking business or bring it to. So, again, for all those reasons, we think that it would be wise to retain the current definition.
Mr. Nelson from the Department of Economic Development, I see you raising your hand. Perhaps you can help us out here.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I am Lee Nelson. I work in legal and legislative affairs at the Department of Employment and Economic Development. The department's name has been bandied about here on both sides as to this particular bill. The department has taken the position, we agree with the legislative auditor's report, that there should be a common definition of independent contractor across all state agencies. We're trying to work with the Department of Revenue to adopt a common definition. One of the problems, as Commissioner Ines spoke just a few weeks ago here in this committee, was the problem with the safe harbor provision, because the Department of Revenue uses the federal IRS definition, and that safe harbor is a problem. And that's one of the reasons we have not advanced this year adopting what the Department of Revenue does. Now, we agree there should be that common definition, but this particular definition applies to the Department of Employment and Economic Development. It does not apply to the Department of Revenue. The Department of Revenue is going to use a general standard, that same one which has been talked about here. And the question is, if it's the goal of the state to have a common definition across state agencies, we're probably not going to have a single definition for the trucking industry, because otherwise you're going to adopt that for the Department of Revenue, which would put it in conflict with the Internal Revenue Service. That's where the problem here lies.
Senator Scoy.
Well, Mr. Chair, and why would it be not possible for the other departments to adopt this exemption that the trucking industry has across all three agencies?
Mr. Nelson.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, the legislature could certainly do that, but then the Department of Revenue and for state withholding could be in conflict with the federal definition, because you'd have a separate special definition only for the construction industry, which wouldn't apply to the Internal Revenue Service and federal withholding. So you could have state withholding and not federal withholding, and so there could be a conflict there. That's part of the problem with adopting definitions in conflict with the Internal Revenue Service definition. You then don't have uniformity between federal and state law, which, as I understand, for income tax purposes, that's the state of Minnesota's policy.
Thank you, Mr. Nelson. Senator Bonoff.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So it sounds like we all think it's important that audits happen so that independent contractors are treated appropriately if they're really not independent contractors. And it sounds like you're saying that the repealer is actually a good thing in this particular bill.
Mr. Nelson.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Bonoff, we don't find the repealer a particular problem.
Okay.
We don't think, quite frankly, when I spoke with the testifiers a few moments ago, I think it's probably more helpful to businesses than it is to the agency in applying it. I don't think that would be a particular problem.
Well, Mr. Chairman, if I might. Mr. Chairman, I kind of am late to the discussion, perhaps, and I hope that, I mean, just mentally, I want you to know that at this very moment I'm having a grandbaby, so I'm thinking about six blocks away from
terrific.
Here. Thank you.
Senator Scheib, what
are Hopefully
you doing?
Hopefully I'll lose a whole bunch of weight after this baby is born. Anyway, I'm in
Grandma
and out
Scheib.
Here. But I'm not sure to whom I should direct this, but I'm wondering, I understand the importance of audits. I think that that's fine. I think we need to get about doing that. But what will the industry then use as standards? I mean, will they use federal tax law standards for who's an independent contractor? Is that what will help them make their decision? Maybe Mr. Hausladen or Ms.
Or Mr. Gertesmeyer. We might want to bring you back up, too. Mr. Hausladen, you want to take the first shot?
Mr. Chair, I think what we're experiencing, Senator Scheib, in the hearing today is, frankly, not having had any opportunity to talk about the content of this bill before the hearing with the senator and those who are pushing it, because I think there are some unintended consequences that would be negative. In very brief consultation with some legal counsel, there's one opinion that says this would go back to case law determination. It would be case by case by case. Again, that is the mess that we are exactly trying to avoid. I cannot say that with certainty, but again, it seems like there were actions in some states where there's some misclassifications. There's a network within state government where this sort of information is communicated in organizations, and there are attempts to say, well, what's going on in other states? But again, I say emphatically, I don't think there's any evidence that the definition that we have in Minnesota is causing any problem or misclassification and is doing exactly the opposite. It is leading for very specific classification, and so we don't have those problems.
Okay. Well, and Mr. Chairman, and specifically to your question, Senator Scheib, they would be determined whether or not they're independent contractors under the same requirements as everybody else who's in business. And I think you have a packet
Senator
Scheib, there that indicates that. So.
Mr. Chairman, I looked at this and it looked like it applies to the usual trades. I mean, I think we had that discussion in the last couple of years about the building trades, for example, and there apparently was some abuse of independent contractor status, and I understand that. But I don't know if this, you know, the language that's being repealed is rather specific to trucking, and I don't know, is there specific language in here that deals with trucking? Because this, with a truck, it's got to do with maintenance of the equipment, whereas I don't know that people who are independent contractors, I don't know how much the same criteria applies as it does to trucking. Can you tell me where in here I might find where it really does? I'm sorry, I haven't read this whole
Senator
thing.
Scheib, Senator Scheib, there's nothing in the handout that applies to truckers specifically, but you would be able to generally apply it to them because it applies to everybody else who might become an independent contractor. And the application across the board would be equal for truckers. So while there's a specific statute right now applying to truckers, it's an exception to the statute that applies to every other worker who might be applying for independent contractor status. And so what the bill would do is basically say that the truckers don't have the exception that's on the back of the bill and that they will be treated under the independent contractor language like everybody else is.
Senator Lantz.
And Mr. Chairman.
Senator Tomasoni.
I understand that some people have some trouble here. So let's move the bill, and I will work with Senator Scoy, and I'll work with the trucking industry, and I'll work with anybody else, and if we find out that this thing can't go forward better, I will not move it on the floor. If we can find compromises, I'll do compromise.
Senator Tomasoni, before that motion, let me check again with Senator Lantz, and then I'd also like to ask if there's any further testimony from the audience. Senator Lantz first.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just trying to make sure I understand this Mr. Nelson explanation. The 268.035, the trucking definition, that's specific to the unemployment compensation field. Is that right? Or is that applied more generally?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Lantz, that is strictly to the unemployment insurance program.
So, Mr. Chairman, Mr. Nelson, the Department of Revenue is applying a different definition then to the trucking industry, the definition that's contained in some other places, the federal definition, when they're determining worker status. Is that correct?
Mr. Nelson.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Letts, yes, that's correct. They do not apply 268.035.
Senator Letts.
Mr. Chairman, so the Department of Revenue, which definition are they applying? Is that the federal definition that you stated, or is it a third one?
Mr. Nelson.
Chairman, Senator Letts, they would apply the federal definition.
So, Mr. Chairman, right now the trucking industry is subject to the enforcement and application of two different definitions of independent contractor, depending on which area they're being looked at for. Is that right?
Mr. Nelson.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Letts, it would actually be three. But
what's the third one?
Department of Labor and Industry, if someone were an injured worker who would apply for benefits, they would apply a different definition. But the definition, I should say, for workers' compensation, as I understand, is almost the same as the unemployment insurance. So in effect, I mean, it gets complicated, but in effect, there's probably two totally different standards, the federal standard and this particular standard.
Senator Letts.
Then I'm having trouble understanding if what's the trucking industry's objection if you have to comply with the federal standard of classification as well as this standard. What's the objection just to picking one and applying that?
Mr. Houselon.
Mr. Chairman. Yeah, Senator. Well, again, frankly, the points of dispute tend to be under unemployment compensation before they are revenue, meaning are they or are they not an employee, and that's where the rub tends to be. And so that's why the definition and its being specific is more helpful. I guess if we were to default to just the federal definition, it would be broadening the scope, broadening the tools that perhaps auditors would use, and they would have less precise measurement to, again, assess. And I would just go back and say, trucking is fundamentally different than many other industries, A, because of the size of investment. $100,000 is a common investment to buy a tractor today, just the tractor, the insurance on that, the debt on that. And again, on a given day, I could be driving my truck under my own operating authority as my own trucking company today, self-employed, independent contractor. Tomorrow I could lease on to another company, and I would still be an independent contractor based on my lease. But if I'm an auditor out there trying to determine what today looked like versus tomorrow, when you don't have a specific measurement, that's where you have the problem. So that's, Senator, fundamentally, we think keeping the specificity keeps everything in a tight box, and we know what kind of rules we're playing under.
Senator Skoy.
Mr. Chair and Mr. Nelson, you said that the trucking industry has two standards, basically this standard that we're repealing and the federal standard. My recollection of the discussion that we had in tax committee is that conflict between the federal standard and what the state has for a standard is broader than just the trucking industry. We have that conflict in other areas also between state definition that the agencies are using and the federal definition that the Department of Revenue is using. And my recollection of the discussion we had just a week or so ago is that this is that using two definitions, one in revenue and one in the rest of the agencies, is not just a trucking issue.
Mr. Nelson.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Skoe, you are correct. You are correct. It doesn't just apply. There's a special definition for construction, which was adopted last year. And you do have some conflicts with just the common law definitions in Minnesota with the common law federal definitions. They're relatively minor. But that is part of the point of trying to adopt a uniform one across the board, which is what our agency agrees with, except the problem with the safe harbor provisions under federal law is where the real rub comes in, and we're still working on that. I know Commissioner Innes has been working with Senator Bach on that issue.
Senator Skoy.
Well, committee, it's obvious that there's a lot of problem with the definitions. I think that doing audits is really a good thing, and we need to get a handle on this. But I don't think repealing the language that is working for the trucking industry is a very good idea to do today until we get the rest of this stuff worked out. Now, Senator Tomasoni, you've said that you want to move this bill forward and you won't go forward with it if it doesn't work, but maybe we ought to just leave it here until we work on it and see if there's something that gets worked out. And I mean, I don't know, committee, what you want to do. I was going to move to repeal that, but I kind of think maybe we ought to just either leave the bill here or else I'm going to move to repeal that section.
Discussion? Senator Tomasoni. Mr. Nelson.
Well, Mr. Chair.
I'm going to go to Senator Scoy.
Mr. Chair, in an effort to get some decision here, because this is a place where votes count.
Yes, sir.
And as a former Teamster, by the way, I'll move to repeal Section 2, or to delete Section 2, Senate File 2688.
Senator Scoy moves to delete Section 2.
Section 2.
Section 2. Discussion.
Mr. Chairman, I'd like
Senator Tomasoni.
I'd like to leave it in, so I'd like a no vote, please.
Further discussion. All in favor of the Scoy motion, say aye.
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 Opposed, same sign.
No.
No.
Opinion of the chair, the motion does prevail.
In division, Mr. Chairman.
Division has been requested. Show of hands. In favor of the Scoy motion. In favor, raise your hand. Yeah. All opposed?
Noisy crew.
The motion does prevail.
Hey, Mr. Chairman,
Senator Tomasoni.
I'd like to move the bill, Mr. Chairman.
Discussion on the bill. Senator Tomasoni moves Senate File 2688 as amended and moves it to?
I think it goes to the floor. I haven't heard anybody ask for it.
To the floor. Senator Day.
Mr. Chairman, a question I guess I have. Do we have a problem? And what's the problem? Is there maybe I was gone here for too much of this, but what's the problem?
Senator Tomasoni.
Well, Mr. Chairman and Senator D, I think we have a huge problem.
Huge problem?
Yeah. And it might relate to one particular employer, but I'm not sure that I want to bring it up. Which employer it is, but it appears that we do have a big problem. Otherwise, I wouldn't have the bill here, Mr. Senator Day.
Senator Day?
Well, Mr. Chairman, everything around here is a huge problem with somebody. So, I don't know. Many years ago, I was an old trucker, and nobody's told me about the problem. So, anyway.
Senator Koch.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator Tomasoni, I guess Senator Day just sort of reiterated a bit of my question. I understand that 1 in 7 independent contractors is misclassified. I'd like to know how those numbers relate, if you have them, to the trucking industry. And is there anything that prevents the department from auditing anyway? Or, is it something that we need to require in statute? I thought that I understood from the legislative, after we had the legislative auditor's report, that they were gonna do more of that. But, so is there anything in the statute that prohibits them from auditing the trucking company? Or
Mr. Nelson.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Koch, there is nothing which prohibits the department from auditing any particular group or groups. I'm unaware of any legislation which requires a particular group or industry to be audited. However, it does not represent a problem for us to do it. We did over 3,000 audits of employers in 2007. So, you know, going through the trucking industry and looking at groups of them, or I don't even have any idea how many there are, but presumably it doesn't require every single one. It only requires those who have had problems in other states. We would simply find that out and then audit them. That would not represent a particular problem to do that.
Chairman, and to Senator Dean, Senator Koch, the fact that this is happening in other states and that other states are actually doing specific audits of the trucking industry is an indication that it is a problem and that it's happening nationwide, not just in Minnesota.
Mr. Gerdesmeyer.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, yes, I'd concur with what the senator just said. There's nothing in the statute that says that they have to audit. That's the department's job to do that. But what we felt was with the problems that are ongoing around the country, at least 10 other states, that it might be well to put in a requirement and specifically take a look at those that are having problems and have been found to be misclassifying and underpaying in other states. And that's what prompted us to bring the legislation forward, more or less mandating employment and economic development, take a look, you know, and let's make sure that we do that.
Senator Day.
Mr. Chairman, and Senator Tomasoni, I take it what? This is another union bill? Is this the reason we're doing this?
We're doing it because of a problem in the trucking industry.
Okay. Further discussion on the Tomasoni motion. All in favor, say aye.
Aye. Aye.
All opposed, same sign.
Nay.
Nay.
Motion prevails.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Senator Tomasoni.
Thank you. And now we have Senator Anderson with Senate File 2999, the Safe Cosmetic Act. And welcome, Senator Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. This bill is called the Safe Cosmetics Act, and let me just introduce the subject to you and then talk a little bit about where we're at on this bill. You know, I just learned in the last few months that there's been a lot of research into cosmetic products and personal care products that people use every day, and that a number of them have been found to have chemicals in them that can cause health problems, such as reproductive problems, cancer, other connections to human health issues. And when I learned about this, I just wanted to learn more and did some research, especially thinking about all the young women that we know that use these cosmetics all the time and probably are not aware of what the impact could be on their health. So what I was surprised, I think most Americans truly really would have believed that the products they use every day are safe and are required to be safe by law, by government. But the fact is that cosmetics are really not very regulated at all under United States law. As early as 1978, the USGAO, the General Accounting Office, told Congress, cosmetics are being marketed in the United States which contain ingredients that may cause cancer, birth defects, central nervous system disorders, and other chronic toxic effects. So then we checked into the Food and Drug Administration, which has oversight over cosmetics. And the fact is, according to the FDA's own website, cosmetics and their ingredients are not required to undergo approval before they're sold to the public. I was really surprised to learn that. FDA does not have the authority to require manufacturers to file data on what's in their ingredients. The cosmetics industry is essentially self-regulated in the United States. And there are some 7,000 ingredients in personal care products, all kinds of chemicals. The vast majority of them have very little or no health or safety data that is available that tells you whether they're safe or not. So I started looking at different possible ways of kind of responding to this issue in a way that would be protective of public health. Some countries have very strict regulation in place. The European Union bans a wide range of chemicals in cosmetics. And that's why I have all the magazines. I just wanted to point this out to you because we went and bought the latest European version of some high fashion magazines. We have one in French, one in English, and one in Spanish. And these are magazines from Europe that, this one is British, the English one, that have all kinds of cosmetics ads for the very same products that you'll find here in the United States under the very same name brands. And so we found all kinds of ads that show that. I don't need to show you all the pictures, but let's see. I'll find some of them. So there's all kinds of products that a lot of us will recognize as things many of us have bought or have seen on the shelves. But the fact is, in Europe, these products are heavily regulated, and there's a long list of chemicals that are not permitted to be in these cosmetic products. So the first question is, well, shouldn't we have those same standards of safety in the United States? What I'm proposed in this bill is not a ban, however. What we're trying to look at is disclosure of ingredients. And let me just tell you a little bit about some of the products that we've looked at briefly. I'm not going to do a whole long presentation, but just to give you a couple of examples and then talk about how we came up with the provisions that are in the bill now. I had a lot of interns in there's lots of young women in this building, young women and men who use cologne, soaps, deodorants, other kinds of products as well. So they're also at risk. And looked and to evaluate the products that they use. So I just wanted to point out a couple of them. We have there's a website called Skin Deep that has evaluated thousands of cosmetic products and taken all available information and listed what the ingredients are in these cosmetics and what their hazard potential is. And we just have a few of those examples. The Estee Lauder makeup is listed as, it's a long list of ingredients on the package. And according to the website, ingredients in this product are linked to cancer, developmental and reproductive toxicity, and allergies and immunotoxicity, as well as other concerns. Lancome High Definition Mascara was another one we looked at and were able to buy at a local store. And again, it's listed as having links, some of the ingredients to cancer, reproductive toxicity, et cetera. And Sally Hansen Nail Color, another example. We picked all these up at the store in St. Paul. And it has ingredients listed that are linked to cancer and reproductive toxicity. So those are just three examples. I don't mean to pick on one particular company or two or three, but there's example after example. And this particular product, this is it's a Maybelline mascara. You'll see there's an ad in one of these magazines for this very same product in Europe. But we know that in Europe, there's strict regulation about what can be in this product. And the regulations like that don't exist in the United States. So we talked to the cosmetics industry. And what they tell us, I've had conversations as late as today with representatives of a number of major cosmetic companies. The companies Johnson & Johnson, Procter & Gamble, and Estee Lauder are represented. I'm sure I know they're here today, and they represent a number of the major cosmetic brands. And I think those are the main ones I spoke with. And they say that pretty much all of their products are manufactured and marketed worldwide. And so they argue that their products have the same components in the United States as they do in countries that are heavily regulated, like in the European Union and Japan. So we have a little bit of a difference of opinion about what the facts are. I mean, are these products safe as the ones that are sold in Europe or not? And rather than kind of try to figure out who's right and who's wrong, our solution is to look at disclosure of ingredients. So we're not proposing doing a ban. What we're proposing is just asking for disclosure so consumers at least can have the information. And so the bill that I have now in front of you, this is the engrossment from the Health Committee, has limited what the bill does to two things. And I should say that I'm working with the industry representatives to try to reach a compromise on an agreement on all the language of the bill. But right now what we have is there's two requirements. One is that there's the loophole for fragrance. Under federal law, cosmetics do have to list all their ingredients on their labels, but they don't have to list the components of fragrance. And just about everything has fragrance in it. That can include hundreds of chemicals that can make up fragrance, and it's a proprietary product. And so what we've agreed to with the industry is the first sentence, which says that if the fragrance in a product contains dibutyl phthalate, which a lot of nail polishes we know do, then they would have to disclose that on the label. There's a lot of concern about the whole family of phthalates, which are linked in – there's different types of phthalates, but this particular one has been listed as a reproductive toxin by the European Union and other – and the EPA has classified it as a water pollutant and an air pollutant. So that's a couple of the citations about that. So we've got agreement that particular component should be labeled. The other piece that we're still discussing is the rest of the fragrance ingredients. And so what we had asked in the bill that you see in front of you is that every other fragrance ingredient at least be listed on the company's website, because it could be a really long list. And what we're negotiating is to have a specific list of chemicals that would have to be disclosed rather than everything in fragrance, because the companies argue it's a proprietary recipe that picks out which different chemicals are used to create fragrance. So we're in discussion about exactly what that list would be that needed to be disclosed. And I'm pretty confident we'll be able to reach agreement on that by tomorrow when the next hearing is in the House. Essentially the bill, that's what the bill does. It requires disclosure of this one category of phthalates. And we're talking about a plan to require disclosure of other potentially toxic chemicals. The list that we're working off of is the chemicals that are banned in the European Union, and to use that as the list that they would have to disclose, and along with some other chemicals in the phthalate family. So that's kind of the universe that we're looking at. And so, members, I just want to present this to you as a work in progress and ask you to approve the bill in the form that it's in, with the understanding that by the time I get to the Commerce Committee, my third stop in this bill next week, that we'll have, I think we'll have an agreement about exactly what level of disclosure should be required. And I just want to be clear that I think that requiring disclosure really will help consumers in this case, because as the industry says, for the most part, they believe that they're not using any of these chemicals anyway, and so for the very few that are, they will disclose those, and that information will be readily available to the public. I think the fact that other places have banned some of these products and strictly regulated them, the chemical components, has helped us to be able to have access to safer products. That's what I'm hearing from the industry. But the disclosure requirement will ensure that that's true, I believe, by giving that information to consumers so they have the power to make healthy choices when they buy these products.
Thank you. And Senator Bonoff.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Anderson, thank you for bringing this forward. It raises so many questions. So then I just have a few questions. Mm-hmm. Do you believe that the EU standards are the – you know, state-of-the-art standards, that that encompasses the chemicals, that there's things missing from that? Are you satisfied with what you've learned about what the EU requires?
Senator Anderson.
Madam Chair and Senator Bonhoff, I've had several interns and staff doing research, frenzied hours of research on this over the last couple of weeks, trying to learn as much as we can. So I can't say that I am a total expert on all these chemicals. It's
right.
That takes, you know, as we said in our bill presentation before, you really shouldn't have to be a chemist to be able to buy makeup.
Right.
But so we're doing our best. But I think because they are the strictest regulations, they're based on the greatest amount of knowledge about what's safe and not safe. And I think that the European standards are based on a standard of requiring, I think their general principle that they use in their regulatory framework is that you have to prove things are safe before you can use them, more of a precautionary principle. That's my general understanding. So I think that those standards are pretty good for protection of the public health.
Madam Chair, Senator Anderson, well, one of the concerns I have with Minnesota having a requirement that isn't standard is I know that these are distributed on an international basis, and so changing labeling is very, very complicated to have labeling that's different for Minnesota than others. Would one possibility be to say adheres to the EU standard so that that would just be a blanket? What is that?
Well,
Senator Anderson.
Yeah, that's a very good point. And I mean, just to remind you what the bill right now, it only requires labeling of one thing at this point. The rest of the information would have to be disclosed on a website for that very reason, because it's easier to adjust a website. But I did suggest to them, you know, maybe we should just have a labeling requirement that says this product is approved by international standards or by the highest international standards or whatever. I would be really comfortable with something like that if we wanted to have a labeling requirement. But that's I don't have that in front of you.
And Senator Rosen, and there aren't a few people here to testify, so I want to have time for them as well. So Senator Rosen.
Thank you. This bill, Senator Anderson, actually makes me think about when Senator Dallas Sams in his committee, and they were talking about burning. He goes, "You're not going to take away my burn barrel, are you? You're not taking away my cosmetics, are you?
No,
this
could I promise.
This is an ugly place around here."
No.
What you said about there's one chemical that you're addressing right now. Well, in California, they have addressed lead acetate. This is from your handout. Uh-huh. Lead acetate, formaldehyde, and so we're actually opening this up to many other products that could be have to be disclosed, and it's I just find this we're going down a slippery slope with this.
Madam Chair, first I want to say, Senator Rosen, that there are plenty of products out there that you can buy that are considered safer. So it's good to do the research so that you can keep buying your makeup and feel good about it. But my bill, when it was first introduced, actually was a plan to do what California had done. That was the model that we used, to require disclosure by the industry of all the components that they have. And then what I learned as I was doing more research on this is that in California, because they're requiring all the manufacturers to put all that information, to collect all that information in the state's health department, California intends to put together a database that will be available for everyone to use. So there's no reason to really duplicate what they're doing. That will create all that information is being collected in California. It will be available to all of us. And so the only kind of missing piece is the fragrance. That's kind of the loophole that has that may not come out of the California law. So we were just focusing on fragrance ingredients and requiring disclosure of some of those ingredients.
And about Senator Rosen?
Yes. Well, Madam Chair and Senator Olson, Anderson,
all ingredients are listed.
You said more wholesome or ingredients.
Cool.
And the article here talks about lavender oil and tea tree oil, which I think are wholesome generic ingredients. And they said that they could perhaps grow breast tissue in pre-teenage boys. Mm-hmm. So I think
I think the information that we have or what is being required or what's being perceived in this bill is really nebulous as far as long-term effects. Well, we don't know what wearing a certain kind of lipstick is going to have long-term effects. It's just hard to get your hands around the ramifications of this bill. I think people should be more aware, but it's still, I think, it's opening up. This bill is opening up to a whole other arena of legislation and restrictions.
And Senator Day, did you have a response, Senator Anderson?
Sure. Yeah. Trust me, I thought I knew more about the trucking industry and I know about cosmetics, but one of the things that I wonder about is, it's now, I don't know, if you don't sleep for a while, you probably will realize this, but let's say it's 3 o'clock in the morning and you want to get up and turn your television on, and there's probably about 18 stations that are selling cosmetics, and they're all over the gamut, you name it. How does this affect that? Or are we only going to affect people that are competing with them that are people that are paying us taxes?
Madam Chair, Senator Day, that's a very good question. It's maybe council can help us tell us what the definition of manufactured, sold, or distributed in this state would be, but I would assume that if you buy something over the Internet, it would fall under either sold or distributed in this state. So it would have to meet our state laws. Maybe Mr. Fuller can tell me if I'm right. I hope.
Well, Madam Chair, members, I think she is right. I mean, I haven't thought about that. If something is sold in the state, the manner in which it is sold is probably irrelevant, but I'm not, I haven't thought about it a lot. But if it's sold in, well, it's distributed. Yeah, that would seem to cover it, and it comes here. But it's not crystal clear.
So, Madam Chair, you're saying that somebody that's advertising out of New York or California over the cable, I guess they couldn't then, right? Is that what you're saying?
Madam Chair, I mean, it certainly wouldn't affect their ability to advertise. It would affect their ability to actually sell a product here. So, I mean, I think it would raise enforcement concerns. It would be very difficult to enforce it if you're mail ordering a cosmetic. It's being delivered to your home. It'd be a little hard to enforce this law. But, a lot of these companies are multinational companies, and I'm working with them to try to establish standards that they think they can live with, that work for them in their international sales. And then there may be some smaller local companies that certainly can work with Minnesota requirements as well.
Okay. What I'd like to do is bring this bill back on Wednesday, but if there's people here today who cannot testify on Wednesday, we'd like to hear them today, if that would work, Senator Anderson. Are there some people here today?
I didn't bring any witnesses, Madam Chair, today.
Okay. If there's some people who could testify, because we do have another bill, and Senator Metzen suggested that might be a good way to have some more time to work some of these issues out, that would be our plan. So please come forward, and if you'd identify yourself for the record.
Madam Chair, may I ask a quick question of Senator Shai Anderson while the people are coming? Can you tell me if formaldehyde is the same thing as dibutyl phthalate or if it's just another kind of phthalate? Because that's something that is – there are a lot of people with allergies to formaldehyde, but it's in lots of things as it's used everywhere, and it's certainly used to preserve fragrance and hold the fragrance. So it's in virtually all perfumes, I believe. There are some, and they tend to advertise that they don't have it if they don't have it. But I know I've seen shampoo that says it has formaldehyde. I know of a couple shampoos that don't because I'm one of those people that has had some allergy to it. Is that formaldehyde? Senator Anderson.
Madam Chair, I think some of the industry representatives could probably answer that better than I could.
Okay. Thank you.
Madam Chair, thank you very much for taking the time to see us today. My name is Nancy Loudon. I'm Vice President and Deputy General Counsel of the Estee Lauder Companies. And Senators, thank you for seeing me. I'm here today with my colleague, Martina Ruppel, who is the Global Executive Director of Regulatory Affairs for Aveda down the road, one of our finest brands Aveda is now 20 years old, employs about 850 people in the greater Minneapolis-St. Paul area. And the other lauder companies, including Origins, Mac, Bobby Brown, and others, also employ quite a number of people in this state. As we've indicated to Senator Anderson, industry, major companies, would very much like to work with her to see if we can reach an agreement on an effective bill. And to that end, today, along with representatives of Johnson & Johnson and Procter & Gamble, met. We would have some very basic disagreements with some of the stuff, I say respectfully, that you just had to say. But nonetheless, we are all in support of making sure that our customers feel that they're making wise decisions and informed decisions. Just want to say a couple of things. First, indeed, it's not a question that we're arguing. The products that we sell in the United States are the very same products that we sell in Europe. Just in Europe, the information that's on the packaging is in five languages rather than one. Our products are manufactured largely, almost exclusively, in the United States and in Western Europe to very high standards, as are the other major companies, who represent in formulating to the strictest requirements around the world, we are selling very safe products in the United States. On the question of fragrances, it's not a question that we don't want to share information about what's the juice in fragrances, but it's very proprietary information, and in the vast majority of cases, the companies don't own those. They know what's in it, but it is the fragrant houses that create them, and for centuries and centuries and centuries, fragrance manufacturers are very, very protective, so much so that not only does the United States government recognize this as a proprietary right, but all major governments around the world. To that end, again, we would very much like to work with the senator and with Representative Knuth to the degree we can, but we still have some important issues to iron out. And I'm grateful that we have a couple of more days to see if we can reach an agreement. You covered a lot of ground, and I'm going to spare that today unless there's a particular issue. To the question, dibutyl phthalate is not formaldehyde, to my understanding. And the vast majority of cosmetics manufacturers do not put formaldehyde into their products. There are a lot of ingredients that people can be sensitive to, and people do tend to look for those. All of our companies also have, however, round the clock in many cases, 800 numbers that people can call for information, and we make a great deal of effort to get information and to satisfy our customers. We are very, very confident, given that the vast, vast majority of products that are sold in the United States come from major manufacturers, both for mass distribution and also for the department stores. There's a high, high level of confidence in our products. There are people who disagree, and that will be worked out over time. We also, though, as an industry, need to look, just as Aveda 20 years ago was a very small business, and there are other small manufacturers, some of which actually have grown considerably, who are based here in Minnesota, that whatever standards are put in place, we want to bring all the standards of the industry up, but some of that sometimes takes time and a form of education that as an industry we're very interested in sponsoring. So I thank you for seeing us. Martina, did I miss anything important?
No, I don't think so.
Martina.
Okay. Thank you for seeing us today.
And are there questions since they may not be back? Senator Skoy.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just have a question about the labeling. My little bit of experience about labeling is that it's quite expensive to change, and whether it's one ingredient that's changed or a whole list, you still have to change the whole label. If this law did require this special labeling in Minnesota over what you sell, you know, elsewhere, how would your company deal with that? I mean, would you change the label just for Minnesota?
We would change the labeling for the United States. And whether you're a small manufacturer or a large manufacturer, you know, yes, someone could try to sticker over for a while or do something like that if they're a small company. But labeling changes do take time. They do take money. And giving people a lot of advance notice
and making sure that the changes that you're making are good ones, necessary ones. You know, it's a very, it can be a very expensive process, yes.
Senator Skoy.
And then, Madam Chair, I'm having kind of a hard time getting my head around this disclosure stuff. And you've got the list of ingredients on the label except for the fragrance, but then there's this web club Skin Deep that disclosed all the ingredients. What's that about? I'm having a hard time getting my head around that.
Well, Madam Chair, Senator Skoy, this is a website that's put up by the Environmental Working Group. It's an environmental advocacy group, and I'm not sure where they've gotten all of their data, but they've combed, I think, what's available on the Internet. And they list fragrance as something that could be toxic, but they don't know because they don't know what's in it for the most part. So I don't think it's inconsistent. They list, you know, components that are known. Based on, there's some voluntary disclosure that the industry does on a federal website, but that's not easily accessible by the public. You have to do a Freedom of Information Act request, I believe, to get at that. So you have to get it from other sources. But some of the companies have their own websites with some information on them, as well as list ingredients on labels. So the fragrance piece is the one piece that is pretty much pretty well guarded secret. And so we're just trying to get at least the chemical components that could be of concern in the fragrance mix out somewhere in the public so consumers have, you know, so access to that information. And I know there's been kind of different industry representatives that have come to talk to me over the last few days, and I appreciate they're all trying to catch up with me here. But at the last committee, I heard that there was agreement about the one labeling change, which was for the dibutyl phthalate. And I think mostly it's because most of them don't use it. But it is still used in a few products, and some of them already disclose it on their labels, like some of the nail polishes. So I don't know that it would change a lot of companies' practices, but it might change a couple.
Okay. We do need to get to Senator Bach's bill yet. So if we could...
Just one more quick question. With regard to the fragrance labeling, did I hear that there's some national recognition of confidentiality or something with regard to fragrance? What was that all about?
Under the thank you for asking. It's always good when you bring the right piece of paper. Under the Code of Federal Regulations, there is a specific provision, Part 701 for cosmetic labeling, requiring that on each package there's a declaration of names of ingredients in descending order of predominance except for specific fragrances or flavors. And that is in recognition of the fact that there's a proprietary nature to the fragrance makeup.
So, Madam Chair, I believe it's not required to be disclosed. It's not.
We have no ability, frankly. The vast majority of fragrance houses that we purchase from, contractually, we are prohibited from disclosing it. It is, we know what is in it. We make sure that the products, that the ingredients are safe, that it's being developed when it's being developed to the highest and appropriate standard. But it's a limited number of people who get that information, and we are prohibited from sharing that. And we are not alone as an industry. Fragrances, for all purposes, tends to be the case.
Thank you very much. And so, Senator Anderson, if you could contact Senator Metzen's office as you come together with this, and it can be rescheduled for Wednesday to come back.
All right, if you'd like me to come back, I certainly will. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Senator Bach, Senate File 3218. Senator Bach, welcome to the testimony table, and this is on Workers' Compensation Advisory Council recommendations adoption.
Madam Chair, I hope I have better luck than Senator Anderson did here this afternoon. Just a little background for those of you that aren't familiar with the process that we recognize that as it relates to changing workers' comp law. I believe it was in 1992, I think Senator Hottinger was the one who's been credited with creating the Workers' Comp Advisory Council. and it was the recommendation of the legislature that time to try and take workers' comp out of the legislative arena and try put it back into the community of people who depend on the system. That would be labor and management. So the advisory council was created. It has six management representatives, six labor representatives, two senators, one from the majority, one from the minority, and two House members, one minority, one majority. And the intent of it was, and they are asked to make recommendations annually to the legislature on proposed changes in the workers' compensation system. And it's been a very, very difficult process because of all of the other providers that are dependent on this system. The law actually prohibits any members that represent attorneys, healthcare providers, qualified rehab consultants, or insurance companies from serving on the council. And the intent of that is those are the providers that work within the system, and it would be inappropriate for them to be recommending changes. So there have been a number of bills come forward proposing to modify the workers' comp system since the last changes were made in 1995, and we've had a difficult time getting anything into law because even when labor and management can seem to come together and agree, I remember 2 years ago, labor and management agreed, brought forth a bill, and the chiropractors and the physical therapists were able to rally members at the legislature and derail the bill. Last year, the labor and management were able to come together and brought a bill to the legislature, and the hospitals were able to derail the bill. And I'm hopeful that this year we don't suffer the same fate. There's a number of provisions in the bill that are kind of housekeeping that have been waiting for a number of years for the legislature to finally enact some kind of a workers' compensation bill. But with having said that, I'll walk through the sections in the bill. Section 1 does two things. It makes it clear that in the case of personal care assistance, those are the people that go out and do home care type things, that it clarifies that if a personal care assistant is misclassified and does not have workers' compensation being paid on them, and they have some kind of a workers' comp injury, that it's Health and Human Services ultimately that must pay if there's no workers' compensation available to that personal care assistant. The other thing it does is it makes it clear that in the case of Medical Reserve Corps volunteers, that the Department of Health provides workers' compensation coverage for them. Section 2 is a cross-reference to a law that was enacted in 2007. Section 3, and this is really the meat of the bill, Section 3 raises the maximum weekly compensation that an injured worker can receive from $750 a week to $850 a week. And it also increases the period of time that an individual can claim temporary total disability benefits from 104 weeks to 130 weeks. And that's probably the major provision in the bill that I'm pleased that labor and management were able to come to an agreement on, because it's been a number of years since the maximum benefit that an individual is able to claim has been raised. Section 4 refers to qualified rehab consultants, QRCs. You've probably received some letters on this issue from back home. Raises their reimbursement from $88.06 per hour to $91 per hour. Normally, under law, they're capped at a 2% increase, and this would be an exception to that. Section 5 extends the period of time that an injured worker has to request retraining. Under current law, they have 156 weeks, and during that period of time, they have to request retraining benefits. This would lengthen that period of time to 208 weeks. Section 6 prohibits unlicensed and unregistered alternative health care practitioners from being reimbursed. I think there's a little bit of disagreement about this provision yet among one of the small providers that's not licensed or registered, and we'll have to work on that. And I just would they sent me a note. Well, this bill's been around here, but I got a note when I was sitting at that table requesting to sit down and talk about this. That's unacceptable, Madam Chair. This bill has been at the Workers' Comp Advisory Council for about a year as people are working through this. And I just would suggest if anybody sitting behind me has some issues with anything in here, they should bring it to Commissioner Svigum and try to work it through the council so that labor and management agree, because everything in here is something labor and management have agreed to. And I think labor and management need to agree to any amendments that get made to the bill. Section 7, and this section is the reason that this bill needs to be referred to the State and Local Government Committee. It allows the commissioner to have some additional rulemaking authority relative to the fee schedule, updating the fee schedule every 3 years. And in the workers' comp system, we use the Medicare fee schedule, the numbers that are the same as assigned to Medicare procedures. And when new procedures come along, the fee schedule needs to be needs to recognize the new changes, the new procedures that are in the fee schedules. But it does need to go to state and local government because of the rulemaking authority here. Section 8 says that if you provide a workers' comp service, that you would be reimbursed by the rate that's applicable to your state. And let me just use an example. If you are an individual from Moorhead, for example, and you're hurt on the job and you go over to Fargo for a procedure, the medical institution in Fargo would be reimbursed at the rate applicable under Fargo, under North Dakota law. Section 9, back in, I believe I was the author of this provision back in 1995 that allowed employers that were large enough or who wanted to form a group to self-insure for workers' comp purposes. And it's been a very successful program, but it had some very high thresholds. Only larger businesses were able to enter into this, and you needed to be an employer who had at least $250,000 of premiums for workers' comp in a year, or you needed to be a group of employers that had $2 million of premiums for workers' comp insurance a year. That's been a very successful program. We'd like to make it available to smaller employers under the same conditions that it has to be a jointly administered thing between labor and management, so it has to be provisions in a collective bargaining agreement. This would allow more employers to enter into that program. I know recently I heard that the grocers and their union may be interested in getting into a self-insurance type program similar to the one in law, which I think is largely, for the most part, is still, was the construction industry as a pilot program, and we opened it up to others, but still I think it's largely a construction industry program. Section 10 clarifies that where an individual was uninsured for workers' comp purposes and they need some kind of medical equipment or supplies, that when labor and industry goes out to purchase those, because the individual is uninsured, that they don't have to go through the regular state purchasing procedures. And that is the same way, the way we're proposing to change this is the same way that the state procures these things for our own state employees now. We don't go through state procurement for our own employees. So this just would mean that where an individual was uninsured and needed, for example, a wheelchair, we wouldn't have to go through the regular state bid process to purchase that for them. We'd purchase it the same way we purchase that kind of equipment for other state employees. Section 11, there is a group called the Minnesota Insurance Guarantee Corporation and there's a premium paid to them by insurers. And we allow very large employers, employers that have over $25 million in net worth, to not pay into the Insurance Guarantee Association. There was a case, and what that means is they are responsible to pay. MIGA is responsible to pay when an employer goes bankrupt. That guarantee corporation actually is the one that actually ends up paying the benefits or paying the medical. But we exempted the large employers because we thought, well, a company with $25 million is probably not going to declare bankruptcy. But indeed, there was actually one case where a large employer went bankrupt and refused to pay a workers' comp obligation. What this does is allow a MIGA to pay that claim and then to assess back to that employer the cost of the benefits and of the penalties so that the injured worker has a continuation of benefits. Section 12 allows labor and industry to issue a penalty against a rehab provider for not filing reports on time. Section 13 allows a different methodology for workers' compensation audits. Currently, when labor and industry goes in to do a workers' comp audit, they have to go through every transaction. This would allow them some flexibility where they could use some statistical type sampling data rather than going through every provision in the workers' comp system. Section 14 allows the department to assign a worker's identification number rather than use the employee's Social Security number. Under current law, the workers' comp system works on Social Security number, and I think we all know we've been trying to get away from that. So this would allow the department to issue a worker ID number. Section 15 authorizes the department to file documents and signatures electronically. That's currently not allowed for. We allow that in a lot of state agencies, but we don't allow that as it relates to workers' compensation. Section 16 updates a cross-reference because in Section 17 we're repealing some obsolete sections related to federal tax credits, and because we're repealing the provisions in 17, we have to do a cross-reference in Section 16. So much of that is technical, but members, that's a summary of what's in the bill. Other than the one little provision on alternative care providers, I think it's in pretty good shape. I don't know how many more committees we have to go to, but I'd request that the next one we go to is state and local government. Be happy to answer any questions. And I think the Commissioner of Labor and Industry is here, and he's also available for questions.
Are there questions? Well, Senator Bach, would you like to move this forward then, please?
Madam Chair, I would move that Senate File 3218 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Committee on State and Local Government.
Are there any questions? And I just want to thank you for the important work that's been done on this. To have a bill come to us in this form is just terrific. I appreciate everyone listening during that discussion. And if people do have concerns, you need to go to, I believe, Commissioner Swiggum with this, with your concerns immediately before it moves forward. So on Senator Bach's motion to move Senate File 3218 to local government.
Madam Chair.
Senator Tomasoni.
Madam Chair, I think Senator Bach's the author of this bill. I think if they have concerns, they should go to Senator Bach. And
he had directed us to go to
Madam Chair, my concern is that changes go through labor and industry so that they're run by labor and management, so that I don't want to carry anything in this bill that labor and management don't both agree to, and I don't want to act as their mediator. That's what we pay the commissioner for.
So I was going on his recommendation, Senator Tomasoni. But sure. I'm sure that they will go to whomever they would like to go to if they have concerns, including yourself. So on the motion, all those in favor, please say aye.
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 And opposed, same sign, and the motion does pass. And with that, meeting is adjourned.